Welcome, good librarian, to episode number 3 of the Library of Horror podcast. You just heard our theme song by T-Virus, entitled Horror Night. Coming up, there's a great song called Horror Story by The Dishwashers. And then we get a fantastic story called Snapshot, read and presented by noted author Scott A. Johnson. Then we get a wonderful story by Tanya Brown. This one's called Sweet Tooth, and it holds a sweet place in my heart, 'cause it's about a dentist. We get a song called Whore Hotel by Use to Abuse. And then we get a most excellent full production story by William Todd Rose called The Bloodshed. And then we get Witches in Bikinis singing Horror Film Chicks. There'll be a few out comments by your good old Dr. Puss, especially pimping the Library of Horror books. And then we're going to go out with a song. And this one's a hoot. It's by Dickie Goodman called Horror Movies 1961. Thank you for being here for episode number 3 of Library of Horror podcast. And you know, you are welcome here. Hey ho! Let's go!
Whoa!
The Library of Horror podcast is now very proud to present a story by noted author Scott A. Johnson.
Snapshot. In Bernard's hands, a camera was powerful, more so than any gun, any sword, any painter's brush. His camera captured the world for what it was. Painters, though talented, were not true artists to him so much as they were professional liars, able to cover imperfections, omit telling details, add sweetness and color to a cheek where none sat. True, they could create an image that might seem to leap off the page, but those images weren't true. They were still just the artist's interpretation of what they saw, no matter how skilled or detailed the painter's hands. But in his hands, oh, in his hands, a camera brought forth life, captured every minute detail, recorded every glint of light, every blister, every darkened wrinkle for the world to see. A camera never lied, never sheltered, never pandered. It only saw and recorded the truth, no matter how beautiful or ugly it might be. In the park, his favorite place to sit, Bernard set up his tripod and felt in his bag for his camera, his most prized possession. Let the others keep their high-tech, high-speed digital marvels of the modern age. Digital was not for him. The images were too easily corruptible, too easily edited. For him, the images had to be captured in a special way. For his art, only a single camera would do. The flat box he pulled from his bag was an anachronism, pulled from a museum, maybe found in some long-forgotten corner of an attic. It was luck that he found it in the old curio shop, but it was almost as if the thing called to him, drew him to the glass cabinet and pulled his eyes to the corner where it sat opened and covered in dust. The last time a camera of its kind was sold new, FDR was president and gasoline was considered expensive at 18 cents a gallon. Still, when he asked to see it, the old man behind the counter smiled and brought it out. It was still in working order, he said, and he would gladly sell it to Bernard for a token price. It took him the space of two breaths to make up his mind, and moments later, he carried his prize home and began searching for film. As it turned out, Kodak still made film for their Best Pocket Series camera, though requests for it were few and far between, and it only came in black and white. Fine, he decided. Truth was determined in black and white and shades of gray. Color distracted from the truth anyway. Delighted, Bernard set to work cleaning and oiling hinges, adjusting springs, and loved the camera back to life. Then he waited with all the patience of a narcotic-addicted squirrel for his film to arrive. When it did, he wasted no time and loaded his camera and went out in search of faces to capture, truth to be revealed by his art. His first subject was a young woman and a man, he assumed her lover, who sat on a bench beneath a tree in the park. Through his eyes, she was beautiful, he was handsome, and they were in love. But when he arrived home and rushed to his dark room, the image in the photograph revealed more than he could have expected. The man was truly in love with her, that much anyone could see. But the woman, in the stark black and white and shades of gray, the truth showed in the lines on her face, the cut of her clothes, the faraway expression in her eyes. She did not look at him, but rather watched another man passing by. The bleached white band on her finger showed where a ring should have been, and the cut of her skirt was just a bit too high. In the photograph, it became clear to Bernard that she didn't love the man. Her hair, light gray in the image, darkened near her scalp. It wasn't real. What he took for beauty at first glance revealed itself in the photograph to be shallow, a mask of loveliness beneath which lurked an ugly person. Fascinated, he tacked the photo to the wall and went in search of other hidden truths he could expose with his camera. For weeks he haunted the park, snapping photos with his ancient eye, capturing children, animals, adults. Any who crossed in front of him found themselves unwitting subjects of his need to reveal the truth. Puppies that seemed cute and friendly came clear with muddy paws and disease-ridden mouths. Children that looked playful and happy betrayed greed as they wolfed down ice cream, and self-centered abandon as they soiled their clothing and smiled at children less fortunate than they. A photo of a homeless man, dirty and avoided by anyone else, revealed kind eyes and a genuine smile, despite his situation. So much ugliness, so much beauty, so much hidden. He felt a perverse joy at his discovery. On a Sunday, he took his camera to the park as usual, eager to capture more truths and unmask the world. He thought about a display, a showing at a gallery, where he could unveil his vision and confront the world with its own pretensions. No filters, no airbrushes, no digital pen to slim the fat or erase the blemishes. Just truth, in black and white. As he walked down the path, he paused at random intervals, snapping photos of people whom he thought looked interesting, wondering what secrets his lens would reveal about them in his darkroom. Boulders here, trees there, the occasional animal, but mostly, he photographed people, took them unawares as they went about their business. What would they be, he wondered, when he managed to get a good, close look at them, frozen in time. When he arrived home that evening, he felt satisfied. His cartridge was full, and the smell of developer and fixer beckoned him from his darkroom in the basement. It took him nearly an hour in total darkness to apply the chemicals to the film properly, a process he'd practiced and perfected over many nights and several canisters ruined. When he at last turned on the amber work lights, he felt as if the day's shoot would reveal more to him than any other. He loaded the film into the enlarger and set to work, pulling the images onto paper. The first few were nothing special. Images of people who wore their disguised selves like sheer pelts, opaque in the sun but transparent to his camera's lens. In one, a mother looked at her child with despair in her eyes and a false smile on her lips. In another, a man spoke to a young lady while his eyes followed another woman down the path. One after another showed lie after lie until he was certain there wasn't an honest person in the city. But the last photo in the spool caught his attention. The subject matter was not very different than the others, but there was something odd about the image. Beside the young man in the periphery stood a tree. In truth, there were trees all around him, but one in particular caught Bernard's attention. It wasn't the focus of the picture, but it was clear enough in focus that he noticed something strange about it. He adjusted his enlarger to its highest setting and focused it on a small section of the bark. There was something there. He was sure of it. He slid another sheet of photo paper into the holder and pressed the button to expose the image, then held his breath as he submerged the sheet into developer. As the image grew more clear, he stared. The whole page was filled with the rough lines and texture of bark, except in one small area where there appeared what seemed to be fingers. A hand, even, reached around the trunk, its clawed fingers dug into the bark. He slid the photo into a tray of fixer, then hung it to dry, then clicked on the main lights. It could have been a blemish on the tree, perhaps a tear in the negative, but damned if it didn't look like a small clawed hand reaching around the base of the tree. He snatched the other photos from where they hung and took them to the living room where the light would allow him to see more. Once there, he took a magnifying glass from his desk drawer and sat down to re-examine each print. There, in each, were tiny signs, imperceptible details of whatever the little things were, and he'd never noticed them before. In several, what he mistook for a leaf might very well have been a tail or an ear. In other, small dots of light might have been eyes reflecting the sun. But the last photograph stole his breath away for the second time that day. Now that he'd seen them, whatever they were obvious. Tiny black taloned hands reached around the back of the bench. Glistening eyes peered from between the slats, reached into a boy's knapsack, touched his shoes, and he never noticed. Bernard went back to his darkroom and his negatives, and stayed up the whole night redeveloping images, refocusing on the backgrounds, and marveled as he saw signs of strange creatures that passed among the normal people unnoticed. The next day, he gathered the best of his prints and took them to a gallery. The owner huffed his skepticism over the legitimacy of the photos, but as Bernard explained how he'd gotten the shots, his brow creased with interest. At the end of the day, he agreed to have a showing in his gallery. But there would need to be more photographs, more images of the strange creatures that existed in the periphery, to fill the walls. Bernard assured him that there would be no problem, and set off toward the park, his camera loaded and ready to capture the true nature of the world. The sun beat warm against the treetops as Bernard made his way to his favorite spot, where he'd first captured the unknown little beasts. He decided to forego shooting the passers-by and target the areas where he knew the creatures lay. Trees, bushes, beneath benches and around lampposts, wherever there was an ignored patch of darkness, wherever people normally didn't look, that's where he trained his lens. When he'd captured more than a dozen images, he put the camera away and hurried home, eager to see what new animals his safari had yielded. But in his darkroom, he saw none of them. No glancing eyes from beneath benches. No tiny clawed hands reaching around trees. As each image came into view, his heart sank by degrees. Were they gone? Had he lost the knack? Maybe they were never really there to begin with. Maybe he'd imagined them all and managed to convince the gallery owner to follow him in his lunacy. As the last photo came into focus, he felt his breath hitch. The image was a mistake, a shot taken when he pulled the camera off the tripod in haste. Distinct in the photo were his own shoes on the grass, and between them stood one of the creatures, no longer hidden behind a tree or glimpsed in shadow, staring up into the lens with raw surprise in its eyes. It looked for the life of him like a small dog, except it stood on two legs, and its front paws were clawed hands. Great ears like the wings of a bat protruded from the sides of its head, each tufted with coarse black hair. Its black eyes shone against the sunlight, and its snub nose dripped with what he took to be drool. The creature's mouth hung open, revealing rows of wickedly pointed teeth. It at once repelled and fascinated him. And then the thought hit him. The creature was standing between his feet, so close it could have taken a bite out of his leg with its saw-like teeth. And he never saw it. Nor would he have had it not been for an accident. Were they around people all the time? Were they to blame for missing pens and spilled drinks? Perhaps they were malevolent little pranksters playing practical jokes on the world? Or worse. He returned to the park the next day, determined to capture more of them. But this time he knew the trick. Never head on, never on purpose. The only way to see them was at the edges, to take them unawares. Otherwise, they'd hide again and his photographs would be of a false world. He stayed until the sun dipped below the horizon and the light was too shallow for his camera. Throughout the day, he shot image after image of this and that, him and her, she and he, sitting, standing, walking, talking, but without much interest. It didn't matter, though. so long as the little beasts didn't think he was looking for them. As he carefully placed his camera back into his satchel, his stomach fluttered with hopeful anticipation. He'd been so careful during the day, aside from a few nervous glances. When he returned home, he headed to the darkroom straight away without any thought of food or sleep. He had to see them. He had to know if he'd been successful. An hour in total pitch gave him time to think about the images from before, in which hidden creatures stalked mankind unseen. The one image in particular, in which the creature stood in naked glory between his feet, chilled him as he imagined it standing with him, alone in the dark, and he unaware of its presence. By the time he was done, he had a first-rate case of the chills started, but could not make himself stop. The gallery aside, he just had to see. He had to know. One by one, with painstaking care, he enlarged the images to normal sizes, then took them to the light, where, with a magnifying glass, he sought out traces of the little beasts. The first few images revealed nothing. Women, children, dogs, businessmen, normal lies from average liars. By the time he developed his fifth photograph, his mood was sour. Maybe he'd spoiled it by catching them before. Maybe the one caught between his feet told the others to hide from him. Maybe he'd seen the last of them for the rest of his life. When the sixth photo came from out of the fixer, he gave it a half-hearted glance. Two women, each regarding the other with patient disdain, sat on a bench. No doubt they were best friends, but in their eyes he saw jealousy and hatred for one another. But there, just behind the thinner of the two, there was a dark spot, so small, but it made his heart hammer. He took the stairs two at a time until he reached the light of his living room and snatched the magnifying glass from the table. It was one of them. He was sure of it. The dark blob had shape and form, ones he recognized. He scanned the rest of the photo but found no other sign of the creatures. But it didn't matter. He caught one. Even one was worth the hours spent. He headed back down to the darkroom to enlarge the image. When the antique clock in his living room chimed, Bernard looked up from his enlarger with a start. Two chimes. Could it really be that late? Not that it mattered. His photographs absorbed him. Since the sixth, every image contained something wondrous. The seventh held three of the little beasts, the eighth four. By the time he developed his 20th image, it was easy for him to pick them out. A shadow here, a blur there. Why, the park grounds teemed with them. It wasn't until the last image sat on his enlarger that he noticed something odd. Perhaps it was a trick of the light, but it appeared. He exposed the paper and took it to the developer tray. As the image gained focus, he felt his mouth go dry. In the dim amber light, he couldn't be certain, but it seemed. He thrust the picture into the fixer, shook it dry, then raced up the stairs to the bright lights of his living room. There, he didn't need his magnifier to see them. The hairs on his arms prickled at the image he held. There were so many. Dozens of them crowded the photo, surrounded the pudgy boy on his tricycle. But they weren't playing pranks or pulling at his wheels. All of the creatures stood rock still. They stared into the lens of the camera. They knew his purpose was to capture them on film, and to that end they'd given him one amazing shot, but the sight of it chilled his bones. They were staring at him, all of them, with deep-set eyes and drooling mouths. If his experience in photography had taught Bernard anything, it was how to read body language and reveal the truth. Now he wished he didn't know so much. Each of them held their arms away from their bodies a bit, flexed their clawed fingers wide. Their heads were slightly down, and their butterfly-like ears laid back against their scalps. There was anger in their postures, but more than that. Every eye held a vicious gleam, every tooth a cruel curve. Their claws looked sharp enough to rend steel, and their hands fairly twitched to prove it. They knew he'd seen them. He didn't sleep that night. Not for lack of trying, but every time he closed his eyes, hundreds of angry little faces stared back at him. Every creak or scuttle brought him up from his bed with terror in his heart. By the time the sun peeked over the horizon, he was exhausted. But with his fatigue came a sense of accomplishment. The gallery owner would love the new photos, he was sure of it. A shower and breakfast later, Bernard still felt tired but satisfied. He strolled down the street toward the gallery, certain that the pictures in his valise, particularly the one which he referred to as the group photo, would make a fine focal point to his show. But as he showed the images to the gallery owner, he was met with ambivalence. Sure, there were pictures of monsters in the park, but only in the park. Weren't there other places that the little beasts lived? The group photo was interesting, but it looked staged. Couldn't Bernard find these creatures in some other setting? From the way they looked, it seemed they were around people all the time. The thought hadn't occurred to Bernard before. The park couldn't be the only place they lived, could it? Things happened to ordinary people every day that were the obvious influence of the, whatever they were. Surely these creatures must live in other places, like churches and office buildings and homes. Were they in his home? And how many of them could there be? And did they know that he'd seen them? How could they not? Surely they'd seen the photos themselves. Perhaps the scuttling noises he heard at night weren't raccoons or rats in the attic. Maybe, when he stood in the pitch of his darkness, he was never really alone. Perhaps in the inky blackness there were tiny eyes and hungry mouths waiting to commit evil upon him. He opened the door to his house with caution. The living room looked the same, still smelled of dust and fixer. But he could not shake the feeling of being watched. Ridiculous paranoia or not, every step he took past his creatures were here, and maybe they weren't, but he needed to find out. He loaded a new film magazine and went from room to room, snapping photos in each at random intervals. A photo of the toilet, one of the stove. He shuddered when he snapped a picture of his bed, dreading what the image might show him. As he made his way down the hall, he had the feeling of being followed. It was overwhelming. So much so that he spun once or twice and snapped a picture of the empty hallway behind him. When he finished, he opened the door to the basement, his work area, and made his way down. When he flipped on the light switch, the whole space seemed to shrink away. For almost 6 years, the only lights allowed were the dim amber bulbs of his dark room. With the main overhead white lights on, he was amazed at how many nooks and crannies he didn't remember. He was also amazed to realize just how small the space really was. He snapped a few photos, then made his way back up the stairs to the living room. He put his camera down on the coffee table and stared at it. For the first time, he looked at the flat box as something other than an extension of himself, more than a tool for exposing the truth. Though it sat quietly, he regarded it as though it radiated menace. Photos of others exposing the truth of their lives and falsehood he could handle, but he'd never taken photos of his own living space, never turned the all-seeing eye of the lens on himself. In the past, he told himself that he just wasn't that interesting. But the truth was, he wasn't sure he wanted to know what his lens would reveal. Now more than ever, with the prospect of strange creatures in his house, he was certain he didn't want to know. But he had to. The thought gnawed at him as he stared at the damned piece of machinery. if they were here. He wanted to know. He snatched the camera up and made his way back downstairs to his dark room. As he turned out the lights, his heart fluttered. If they were here, he'd be alone with them, in the dark. Would they let him develop the photos? How would they react at being discovered? True, the ones in the park knew he'd seen them, but here, in his own house, where he couldn't just walk away, would there be consequences? He set his mind to the task at hand, removed the cartridge from the camera, and set to work developing the film. It was difficult to manage the task, though he'd done it 100 times before. But his hands shook, and every stray sound echoed in the tiny space, now grown cavernous by the darkness. By the time he was done, he almost couldn't bear to put the film on paper, but his need to know grew, changed into morbid curiosity, not just about the creatures, but about the photos themselves. With each image he developed more than 12 in total, his curiosity grew, so much so that he did not follow his usual custom of looking at each photo as it developed. He developed them all, hung them to dry, and stood watching droplets of fixer and water slide off the glossy paper. When he could no longer resist, he pulled them down and hurried up the stairs to the light of his living room. Once there, he spread the photos out on his coffee table and stared. There was his home, his life, his personality in honest black and white. From the creases on his bed that revealed the poor social life, to the spotless kitchen that showed him to be obsessive, he was there. A single note hung from the refrigerator, which made the thing look lonely and pathetic in the camera's eye. The image of the living room was, at first glance, tidy. Further inspection, however, revealed dust on the shelves and scuffs on the couch. The room was more or less unused, another testament to his lonely lifestyle. When his eyes rested on the photo of the hall, the one taken behind him, he felt his stomach drop. Where he'd only seen carpet and bare walls before, there were eyes, teeth, claws and ears, tufts of hair and angry expressions. He counted more than 20 before he gave up and sat back on the couch. They were here. He glanced back across the mosaic on his coffee table. In every photo they were there, little blobs, tiny shadows, glints that another person might have taken for light coming through the window. Every picture had them. They were here. The photos of his dark room startled him to tears. In the room where he developed the film, the room of pitch midnight black, they crawled on the walls and stood on the shelves, balanced on the drying line and sat on his canisters. He was so afraid of being alone in the dark with them, and they were there all along. In the other section, where he enlarged and developed the prints, they clung to his enlarger and peeked from under the shelves. His eyes came to rest on photos of his bathroom. The creatures peered from behind the shower curtain and hugged his shampoo bottle. One lounged against his razor while another appeared to be scratching its backside on his toothbrush. As he counted, he noticed something in the photo that terrified him beyond reason. In the bathroom mirror, he'd managed to catch his own reflection, camera held in front of his face like a strange cycloptic monster. And in his reflection, he could also see them. They perched on each shoulder, climbed from around his back. On his head sat one that he was sure was the same beast he'd captured between his feet only days before. They were here. They'd always been here, he figured, always darting between his feet as he walked, always staying just out of sight, always watching. How many times, he wondered, were misplaced keys there doing, or broken glasses, or missed telephone calls? How many times had his chemicals gone bad or his light safe leaked? Were they to blame? Did they eat breakfast with him, watch him in the shower, touch him while he slept? The thought made his skin crawl, but more, it intrigued him. So long he'd sought out the truth of the world to capture the raw essence of what was real beneath the fantasy of perception, and now he had it. Proof that what people thought was the real world was only a thin veil. He sat back on his couch and looked around the room. They were watching him. Every glittering eye burned into his skin like a cigarette, but they never came out where he could see them. "I know you're here," he said. At the sound of his voice, the room twittered. Chatters and growls came from every corner. "I know you're here," he said again, louder this time. "And I'm showing the world what you are." The growls grew louder and more chattering voices joined them. They sounded just as he thought they would, like rats or tiny dogs. The voices came from everywhere, down the hallway, behind the sofa on which he sat, above in the light fixture. They heard him. More unsettling was the notion that they'd understood, and they were angry. He snatched his camera from the table and ran to the basement door. He knew they were down there, but so was his film. He needed another magazine. He needed more photos for the gallery. If that pompous ass of an owner wanted dramatic, he'd show him dramatic. The creatures were too small to do any real damage. And when it was all over with, he'd take the money he was sure to get from the gallery and move to another home. A quiet home in the countryside, where nasty little beasts didn't live. At the base of the stairs, he paused and listened. The growls and chatter came from up above, but the darkness of the basement was quiet. He hurried to the cabinet where he kept his extra film stock, tore off the wrapper, and loaded his camera. When he turned back toward the stairs, he froze. So many eyes. So many rows of angry teeth. So many angry little monsters stared at him with hatred in their eyes. No longer content to hide in the periphery, they stood before him bold as brass. On the walls and ceiling were more, all staring, all silent. He was trapped, and he knew it. Bernard saw the sea of angry creatures surge and did the only thing he could think to do. He began snapping pictures. Lights around the entrance of the concept art gallery burned bright against twilight as silk shoes and faux fox wraps strolled up the red carpet. The new exhibit was a smashing success, and Gary Mitchell reveled in the success of his gallery. He knew he had something special in the new photography exhibit from the first moment that odd little man appeared with his photos in tow. But until a week ago, he wasn't sure the showing would be a success. Until the man's mangled body was found in his basement darkroom, that is. It took a large amount of money to convince the judge that the final images in Bernard's camera were his rightful property, but in the end, they were worth the expense. Dead artists, after all, made more money than live ones. The procession of more than 300 people passed from one carefully matted print to the next, each one eliciting more gasps and nervous conversations than the last. A few of the attendees shrieked when they saw themselves in the portraits, unwitting participants in the artist's vision. Still more scoffed at the odd little creatures, calling them obvious hoaxes or careful bits of fakery. The procession made their way through the six main galleries until they came to the last door. The seventh was left bare, with no frames or images on the white walls. In the center of the room, hanging from wires, were the final three photos taken from Bernard's camera. In the first, the sea of little beasts were visible, a few in the front moving so fast that they appeared to be blurs in the grainy black and white print. In the second, the room beyond them was obscured by all their coarse little bodies, their glittering eyes, wicked claws, and razor-like teeth. The last image, one that haunted even Gary to the point that he didn't like to look at it, showed only one of the little monsters. His mouth covering most of the lens, his eyes visible, and in the reflection of his black eye, the photographer screamed.
Sweet Tooth by Tonya Brown. This story first appeared in the anthology Tooth Decay, available for sale from Sonar 4 Publications. Please visit www.sonar4publications.com. Bernie swore he could feel someone lingering in the darkness of the examining room behind him. He looked up from his tray of instruments, lit by a single fluorescent light, and turned, peering into the shadows beyond.
"Hello?" he called out.
No one answered. Bernie shrugged and returned to his work, assuming it was just his empty stomach playing tricks on him. He was late for dinner again, and his wife would be furious, but he had told her more than once that a dentist's work was never done. Especially a dentist with an assistant that didn't seem to understand how Bernie liked his trays sorted.
"Dr. Dover?"
a voice asked from the darkness. Bernie nearly dropped a clean pick on the floor. He snatched it in his gloved hand and clung to its autoclaved goodness with all of his might. He turned again to the shadows, brandishing the sterile pick like a tiny weapon.
"Who's there?"
"Are you Dr. Dover?"
the voice asked in a tone that was more than silky smooth. It played across the ears like oil flowing over the glass. Bernie was compelled to relax, but at the same time he was filled with an utter sense of dread.
"Yes,"
he squeaked as he stared into the shadows. And the shadows seemed so much darker than they usually did, deep and dense and oh so very dark. The shadows moved. They swirled and eddied and drew in on themselves until they took the shape of a man. The man was very tall, very thin, and wrapped in a black cloak almost as dark as the shadows themselves. He stood over Bernie and stared down his regal nose with a stoic look on his pale face. His eyes were violet. His hair was a shade of a starless night. His lips were slender, colorless lines.
"I have need of your help,"
the man said. Bernie stared up in shock as his voice fled him. The forgotten pick clattered to the floor.
"Do you have a free moment?"
the stranger asked. Bernie nodded, but he was unsure as to how many more moments he had left.
"I find that I'm in a regrettable..."
the man paused as if searching for the correct words before he said,
"condition."
The silk of the voice stumbled over the last word. Bernie furrowed his brow, cocked his head at the familiar sound.
"I've been looking for a qualified man,"
the stranger continued.
"One who could handle my problem."
Again he paused and thought before he finished with,
"prudently."
Bernie nodded again. The man seemed very guarded with his speech, as though he were selecting each word carefully, weighing the sound before he spoke it aloud. The man smiled a tight, closed-mouthed smile.
"Good. You came to me highly recommended. I heard you were the best."
The smile fell into a dark frown.
"I hope for your sake this is true."
As the stranger allowed his lisp to surface, the dentist in Bernie pushed aside his overwhelming fear and diagnosed the cause.
"Broken tooth," he said boldly. "Maxillary canine on the right side. That is, if my ears don't deceive me."
The stranger blinked, then smiled another tight-lipped grin.
"So, you're just as good as I've heard. Good. Shall we do business?"
Bernie had no sooner nodded a third time when the stranger disappeared. The dentist rubbed his eyes and blinked in disbelief. Had he imagined the whole thing? Certainly there was a person there, in the dark corner of his office, only moments ago.
"Dr. Dover?"
the stranger said. Bernie jumped from his stool, almost knocking over his carefully organized tray as he whipped around. The stranger was reclined in the examination chair, with his head cocked back on the rest, and his long fingers interlaced over the breast of his dark suit.
"I didn't mean to startle you,"
the stranger said as he lifted his head. Bernie stared, open-mouthed, at the man for just a moment, before he finally found his voice again.
Who are you?"
The stranger rolled his violet eyes deep in their sallow sockets.
"Of course. Please forgive my manners."
He sat up on the edge of the recliner and held his hand out to the dentist.
"My name is Otto Stilsing."
Bernie snapped his jaw shut and took the stranger's hand into his own. The very touch of the man chilled the dentist to the bone, but he held on and pumped the stranger's hand up and down, tentatively.
"Nice to meet you, Mr. Stilsing?"
The man nodded.
"Count Stilsing, actually. You have quite an ear for lifts."
Bernie gave a shy smile.
"Well, it is my bread and butter."
All at once he dropped the stranger's hand.
"Wait a minute."
He took a quick step away, then another.
"How did you get in here? What do you want?"
"Doctor, please. I assure you I am only here with a patient, nothing more."
"Well, I'm afraid you can't just barge in here and expect me to drop everything to see you. You'll have to make an appointment, just like everybody else."
The dentist's words trailed off as the count smiled, wide and full-mouthed this time. The count's teeth were extraordinary, to say the least. White and shining pearls of flawlessness lined his tender pink gums like alabaster soldiers gathered in magnificent formation. Bernie had never seen such incredible incisors, such captivating canines, or such marvelous molars in all his days. The glory, the perfection, the fangs? Bernie narrowed his eyes at the man's upper canines. The left one was long, threatening to dip well past the man's upper lip and sharpen to a fine point. The right one, however, appeared to be gone.
"What have you been eating?"
Bernie blurted out before he knew what he was asking. He couldn't help it. It was in his nature. Dentistry was in his... Bernie's hand flew to his throat. He went pale as the very stuff of his worry fled his face, rushing to fill his overexcited heart.
"Don't worry, doctor,"
the count said.
"You're perfectly safe. I promise. I need your help more than I need you for supper."
Bernie swallowed hard as his heart continued to beat a furious tattoo. "Ha-ha! How could I possibly help you?" The count rolled his violet eyes again and pointed his thin, tapered finger to the gap in his upper teeth. "This? Are you a dentist or not?" And suddenly, it all made some kind of mad sense. This man, this creature, had come to Bernie in its hour of need. And as much as the human in Bernie was instinctively terrified to his very soul of this beast, the doctor in him reached out in sympathy to the poor thing. But, more importantly, the dentist in him couldn't pass up what could prove to be the opportunity of a lifetime. "You want me to examine your teeth?" Bernie asked, his voice stilted with lingering fear. The count nodded, enthusiastically. Bernie steeled his nerves and took a hesitant step towards the count. The count dipped his head back and opened his mouth wide in an effort to help the dentist see into his gaping maw better. But the effect of it was nerve-wracking on the poor man. Bernie covered his eyes and cowered from the sight. "Stop, please," he begged. His eyes watered with anxious tears. The count closed his mouth. "Sorry."
"It's like looking into the mouth of a shark,"
Bernie whispered as he looked back. "A very hungry shark, with one fang." The count frowned as if hurt.
"No need to make fun. I said I was sorry. And if it makes you feel any better, I don't apologize to this anyone."
Bernie stood a little taller.
"That's quite all right. No harm done. Yet."
He got the impression that the count never apologized to anyone. So yes, it did make him feel better. Not safer, but a little better.
"Let's have a look at you in the chair. Maybe that'll take the edge off of it."
And it did. As soon as Bernie had the count laid back in the chair, head on the rest, paper napkin around the neck, the fang was just another tooth, and the monster's maw just another mouth.
"Will you look at that?"
Bernie said, and gave a low whistle.
"What?"
the count asked, with a frown.
"Keep your mouth open, please,"
the dentist commanded. He shoved a pair of foam blocks into the man's mouth to keep it open and silent. Bernie's second impression of the count's teeth were not as glamorous as his first. While each tooth appeared to be a perfect example of its kind, white, shiny, and shapely, upon closer examination the count's gums were swollen and slightly drawn back, especially around the broken canine and its brother. He took a mirror and a pick from the tray and swung his magnifying glass around to get a closer look at the broken tooth. A gaping hole in the gum stared back at him. He narrowed his eyes to suspicious slits and turned the mirror to the opposite canine, confident in what he would find there. Sure enough, just at the back of the impressive fang lurked a small black dot.
"Well," Bernie said, removing the instruments from the Count's mouth. "Count Stilsing, I'm afraid I owe you an apology as well."
The Count furrowed his brow and made a gurgle around the foam blocks that, due to Bernie's years of experience, sounded an awful lot like,
"Apologize? For what?"
Bernie smiled his best professional sympathetic smile and shook his head at his patient.
"The tooth isn't broken."
The Count raised his very dark brow and made a gurgle that sounded something like,
"Not broken?"
"No,"
Bernie said with his best professional sympathetic frown.
"I'm afraid it's fallen out. Root and all."
The Count's eyes flew wide.
"Root and all?"
was his loud gurgle. Bernie clicked his tongue and nodded.
"Root and all."
The Count moaned and gurgled.
"How? How is it even possible?"
The dentist tipped the Count's head back and stared deep into the hole again. The signs were easy to interpret, but hard to believe.
"Rot,"
was all Bernie said.
"Rot,"
the Count gurgled.
"Decay. Tooth decay. Or dental caries, as we say in the profession."
"That's impossible."
And yet it happened.
"You don't understand,"
the Count shouted in a loud gurgle. He pushed the magnifying glass away and sat up, spitting the foam blocks out as he did.
"This is impossible. I can't have tooth decay. That's just silly."
Bernie repressed the urge to agree.
"I'm sorry, Count Stilsing, but you've got all the classic signs. Swollen gums, tooth loss, enamel decay, inner rot. The only thing you lack is infection. You know, tooth loss is usually accompanied by an infection, which, if left untreated, can lead to..."
Bernie stopped when he realized the Count was glaring at him through red-rimmed eyes.
"I don't get infections,"
the Count said, very slowly.
"Yes,"
Bernie said.
"And I guess you don't usually, experience discomfort. Due to your current state of being, I mean."
The Count shook his head. Bernie put his gloved hands together and tapped his forefingers against one another.
"But nevertheless, you do display the indication of someone who's, not brushing their teeth after eating."
"I do not eat,"
the Count announced. A pause lingered between them, and the Count finally added, in a very low voice,
"Food."
"I see,"
Bernie squeaked as he trembled before the brooding monster.
"Well, even so, the evidence is there. I'm afraid that sweet stuff tends to stick to even the smoothest of teeth, and if left alone, it can eat a hole through the enamel."
The Count's cheeks took on a bright scarlet hue, and for a moment, Bernie thought he was done for. Surely the monster, now red with rage, would soon pounce and end the dentist's career, not to mention his life forever. It took a few moments for Bernie to realize the Count was not red with rage. He was blushing. He was embarrassed.
"Do you mean I have cavities?"
the Count asked in a whisper.
Bernie nodded. "That's what took your right canine, and your left one is already showing signs of joining its twin. You might have even more."
"More?"
the Count shouted. He cradled his face in his hands and moaned.
200 years of being so careful!"
He looked up to Bernie and shook his woeful head.
2 centuries of always staying one step ahead of the stake! 2 centuries of keeping my existence a secret from the average mortal man! 200 years of careful aestheticism.
The Count paused and took a deep breath as he looked for another word to express his dismay.
200 years of avoiding every indulgence for the fear of what might catch up with me, and now you tell me I have cavities?"
Bernie heard the Count's lament. Every sound struck him with its lisping yet still silky beauty. But he refused to process the words. He stored them away for later, along with the fangs and the whole idea of what was happening here. He would just go home and lose his mind when this was all done and the Count was far, far away from him. But for now, he would play along with his own insanity.
"Won't it just grow back?"
The Count cut his eyes.
"That's not how it works."
He pressed a finger against his remaining fang and sighed.
"What I don't understand is how on earth it's even possible."
"I hate to sound like a broken record, but..."
"What?"
the Count interrupted the dentist. Bernie shook his head in pity.
It really does go back to what you've been eating.
The violet eyes rolled wildly.
I told you I don't eat food.
Yes, I heard that part. But, what do you...
Bernie drew out the question, hoping the Count would volunteer the answer, as if Bernie didn't already know. The Count pursed his lifeless lips and cocked his head at the dentist.
Okay, Bernie said with a shudder, but it just doesn't make any sense. You see, tooth decay is caused by specific types of bacteria, which I have no doubt your mouth is full of, just like everyone else's.
Hey now!
Especially if you go around putting your mouth on, well, other people's bodies. Bacteria are everywhere, my friend.
The Count blinked in disbelief.
I'll have you know I don't put my mouth on just anyone's...
Bernie ignored him and pressed on.
But the real puzzle is that the bacteria only causes this kind of damage in the presence of fermentable carbohydrates.
Sugars. Sugars. From food. Which I've already said I don't eat.
Yes, food is usually the source, Bernie said.
He drew a deep breath and leaned back on his stool, deep in thought.
Where could you have gotten a hold of sugar?
Fugger, the Count echoed.
Sucrose,
Bernie pondered aloud as he tapped his chin.
Sucrose,
the Count repeated.
Fructose. Fructose. Glucose,
Bernie said, and before the Count could repeat him, the dentist sat up straight and stared at his patient.
Too much glucose.
The Count crossed his arms and turned his head away.
Glucose. Where would I get glucose?
I know exactly where. I've been asking all the wrong questions. It's not what you're drinking, but rather who you're drinking from.
The Count shifted in his seat, kept his head turned away, avoiding the dentist's gaze. His cheeks rose to red again.
You've been drinking the, life fluids of a specific type of person, haven't you?
That's ridiculous,
the Count said. Again, his voice had an echo of familiarity to it, and Bernie recognized it. It was the tone of a liar.
Do you think you're the first, Count Stilsing?
Bernie smiled.
No, I'm afraid not. I've been tried by the very best. Politicians, movie stars, moguls and millionaires, fathers and mothers and their offspring. Everybody sings the same song in my chair. They claim to brush every day, floss between meals, and never, ever, under any circumstances, ever allow sugar of any kind to pass their lips. And they're all liars.
Bernie prodded the Count and the rhythm to his words as he added,
every last one.
The Count suddenly stood, raised his arms to the ceiling, threw back his head, and cried,
Oh, it's true! I'm hooked on diabetics!
Aha! Bernie shouted. Diabetics! I knew it!
I didn't mean to, honestly. It was all a mistake. A horrible, horrible mistake.
Bernie nodded his best professionally sympathetic nod.
I'm sure it was, but as your dentist, I'm going to have to recommend that you give him up. You're going to lose the rest of your teeth if you don't.
He could hardly believe he was counseling this creature of the night on its feeding habits.
I tried,
the Count said as he plunked into the chair again.
But whenever I'm near someone whose blood sugar is running high, I can't help myself. I can smell the sweetness in their veins.
How hard have you tried?
The Count eyed Bernie in silence.
For instance, Bernie said, where do you find such people? I'm sure that someone with phenomenally high blood sugar isn't just prowling the streets at night looking to become a meal for you, are they?
The Count shook his head. Then, Bernie said,
I suggest you start by not hanging out at hospitals and all-night donut shops.
He stood and went to his desk, leaving the Count reclined in the examination chair. The Count frowned as he watched the dentist cross the room.
What about my tooth?
Bernie settled into his chair and shrugged.
I'm afraid there's nothing I can do about that tonight. I suggest you give up sugar and start brushing between meals just in case.
Bernie snatched up a pen and pad, scribbled down a few notes before he added,
Brushing and flossing won't help the existing damage, but it will stop future problems from developing.
The Count sat up, the frown deepening to disappointment.
Here,
Bernie said, as he tore the note free and held it out.
This is an appointment reminder for next Thursday, at midnight.
He wiggled the paper at the Count. The Count smiled his gap-toothed grin.
Really? You'll see me again?
Yes, Bernie said. We might be able to stop the other fang from falling out. Maybe even fit you for a prosthetic. I won't know until we've looked into it better. I need time, though, to rearrange my schedule and make sure I take Friday off so we can do this properly.
The Count leapt from his seat and snatched up the paper.
Thank you so much. I don't know how I can ever repay you.
I have set rates, Count Stilsing. Don't worry. I'll work up an annotated bill, with some special night rates added, of course.
But of course. I just mean, well, thanks. I know this is a bit unorthodox.
The Count sighed.
For both of us.
Bernie smiled.
So, next Thursday, at midnight. Don't forget.
I won't.
And with that, Count Otto Stilsing turned back to the darkness.
And Count,
Bernie asked before the thing dissolved completely.
Yes?
The silky, smooth voice called out.
Please don't ever, ever, ever drop in on me unannounced again.
There was a long pause before the silky voice said,
Once again, I am very sorry. If I was being rude...
Bernie held up his hand.
No apologies needed. I just think that it would be safer for both of us if you only come to me at your appointed times.
Another pause lingered in the gloom.
As you wish.
I don't want to seem demanding, but we were very lucky tonight, Cal Stilsing. Very lucky.
Lucky?
Yes, Bernie said. If my assistant hadn't eaten the last of those donuts, I imagine this little surprise visit would have ended very differently.
Ah,
the silky voice proclaimed its understanding.
I'm not supposed to eat sweets, of course, Bernie said with a grin, but even the most experienced of us diabetics slip now and again.
Till midnight, Dr. Dover,
the voice said.
Till then, sir. Till then.
Bernie breathed a sigh of relief as the darkness ebbed to mere shadows once more, and his mind buzzed with the possibilities of fitting the Count with fanged dentures.
I hear it through the walls, from across the lawn, from behind the door with the cracked and flaking plaint. Steady and rhythmic, constant, insistent. So loud it fills my head, drowning out all other thoughts. Pillow pressed against my face so tightly I can almost smell the bald geese who gave their treasures for my comfort. Hot, so damn hot, like the fires of hell are raging just beneath my bed, and I feel the spit pierce my stomach, rise through my trachea, burning and stinging as everything begins to spin. Into the blood-red darkness of eyes squeezed shut, it invades. First with the moist stench of mildew-bloated wood. Next, the smooth shingles that once were as rough and scratchy as cat tongue. The broken window. Jagged glass, tooth-like, in the gaping maw. It pulls itself into existence, piece by piece. Slat by slat, one dust mote at a time. Nasty little gnomes with noses half eaten by time. Their smooth eyes, blank voids, but seeing nonetheless. Peering into the hidden places of my soul, branding me with their stares. A rusty tool, curved blade, wooden handle. Dangling from a nail bent in the shadows. Hammers, screwdrivers, an axe with a split handle that pinches blood blisters from the skin. Shovel, trash bags, duct tape. The big, dirty doll with the tiny voice. Half-molted Santa, face drooping and dripping like candle wax, one eye permanently squinted.
Miss Henderson throws salt in the garden when you're not looking. I've seen her. So naughty.
Pills. Blister pack of yellow oblong tablets. Bitter like a bad walnut as it dissolves on my tongue. Wife said they'd help. Doctor said they would help.
We'll help you.
But none of them knew. The black candles. The bell. The chalice in graveyard dirt. The blood. The shed. The blood shed. Dewy grass. Cold and wet on bare feet. Big pussy moon hiding behind a thin veil of clouds. Crickets and wet PJ bottoms. Soft breeze. Door creaking open as tools and junk and relics from a lost life sigh.
Welcome.
Screams. Mine. Maybe. No.
Then she heard what sounded like a growl. So she went down to the cellar wearing nothing but a towel. Beautiful and brave, but no brains in her head.
the beach, a boy gave Nell a note. It said to hurry up and join her friends back at the boat. But when she came, there was nobody there. Just a trail of blood and guts that she followed down the stair. Beautiful and brave, but no brains in her head. Doesn't have a clue that any second she'll be dead. She's a horror flick chick. Dangerously thick. Ew, ew, misses every single trick. Ew, ew, cause she's a horror flick chick. Try to guess how the story would unfold when the killer trips and knocks himself out cold. Does she turn away and run? Somebody stole his favorite bone. Then the little pooch gave out a yelp. So in her nightie she went out to see if she could help. Beautiful and brave, but no brains in her head. Doesn't have a clue that any second she'll be dead. She's a horrific chick.
That's it, good librarians, for episode number 3 of Library of Horror podcast. I want to thank everyone that contributed to this most wonderful podcast. Y'all are sending in some great stuff. Some of it I don't even have to touch. I just have to amplify it a bit. And I thank you for that. Gives you good old Dr. Puss more time to work on the other things that he has to do. Now, for you listeners that don't know, and for you good librarians that do know, we have an imprint called Library of Horror Press, with more than a few books out and available. One is City of Demons by Scott A. Johnson. Another is a huge collection by Eric S. Brown and John Grover. It's over 100,000 words, called Tandem of Terror. And Dave Dunwoody has given us the most excellent collection, called Unbound and Other Tales. We have the most wonderful book by Derek Goodman, called The Apocalypse Shift. And The Black Act by Louise Bomer. Rhiannon Frater has given us The Tale of the Vampire Bride. There's a collection put together by Eric S. Brown about werewolves, but these are special werewolves because it all has to do with military wolves. It's called Wolves of War, and coming soon. It's in proof right now. Is Mr. Moon's Nightmares by Jonathan Moon. This one will just knock your balls off. So check out Amazon.com, or you can order them from your local bookstore. Just tell them to look them up in the Ingram catalog. And support Library of Horror Press. Next episode, we have more from Scott A. Johnson, more from Tanya Brown, and a few other big surprises for you. Hopefully, Corey can give us another review of a horror DVD. And copying from Library of the Living Dead podcast, we're going to go out with a song. This one is a crazy one, by Dickie Goodman, called Horror Movies 1961. We'll see you next time in episode number 4 of Library of Horror Podcast. Let's go out with a song!
I took my baby to a horror show. That's the only place she wants to go. She thinks that Dracula is so divine, and she wants to go steady with a Frankenstein. She's crazy about the creature from outer space. She thinks that the werewolf has the fuzziest face. She's gonna have a party in the mummy's tomb, and she's in love with the creature from the Black Lagoon. My baby loves a horror movie. My baby loves a horror movie. My baby loves a horror movie.
Yeah, well.
She's mad about the monster from the Black Museum, the invisible man, and she can't even see him. I better do something to get close to her, or I'll lose out to Godzilla or Tarantula. I gotta find somebody who can make me change into a horror monster with a face that screams. I know that girl would have eyes for me if I look like a man from a million BC. My baby loves a horror movie. My baby loves a horror movie. My baby loves a horror movie.
Yeah, well.
There's a crazy old professor living just outside who could change Dr. Jekyll into Mr. Hyde. He's got the wildest laboratory that you ever seen. And over in the corner is a monster machine. I say, look at here, Professor Man, you know what I mean. Come on and make me like a monster on a movie screen. My baby says that she don't like my face, so I gotta have a scary one to take its place. My baby loves a horror movie. My baby loves a horror movie.